shown to be very effective at teaching that this is a
Art Spiegelman,
mistake.
We have to leave it there, but I thank you so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the return of Portland Folk Music Society concerts with artists who tour nationally. The five-concert series starts this month, Saturday, February 19th, with Robin and Linda Williams.
Give me a good heavy load and a clear stretch of road, and I'll let that old bulldog run.
The Portland Folk Music Series has one show every month through June. The concerts will be at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele Street in Portland. For information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
Some quiet mood music, some soothing sounds.
Well, then never listen to Life During Wartime, because they just play really obnoxious DIY punk from local bands and international acts. Sometimes they have bands play live, and it's all with the yelling and the screaming and the I don't like my mom and dad or my teachers and all that kind of stuff. That's Life During Wartime, every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, former Portland Mayor Bud Clark dies at 90. Portland branches of Starbucks vote on union. And in international news, general strike 1 year after coup in Myanmar. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 2nd, 2022. I'm Ethan Sandwise. Bud Clark, Portland's former citizen mayor, died yesterday at the age of 90. Clark is best known for his poster, Expose Yourself to Art, in which he is flashing his trench coat at a nude statue on the Transit Mall, the weird mayor before Keep Portland Weird bumper stickers. A tavern owner with no political experience, Clark defeated the heavily favored City Hall insider Frank Invancy in 85. During his two terms as mayor, the city developed a nationally recognized plan for caring for the homeless, built the Oregon Convention Center, and shifted toward community policing. Clark also started Bike to Work Day, made the Great Blue Heron the city bird, and threw Bud's Ball, a giant party with hundreds of bands. Portland faced a budget shortfall when Clark took office, but he left with substantial reserves. Former City Commissioner Mike Lindbergh said, quote, "Everywhere we went, we were swamped with people, and it wasn't for me. He had a magnetism and charisma about him." Several local Starbucks are joining a nationwide push to unionize. Here's KBOO's Josh Salem with more.
Three Portland-area Starbucks stores have filed for union elections, joining more than 50 other stores nationwide. Two of the unionizing branches are in Beaverton, and one is in southeast Portland. Workers at the store were inspired by a successful effort in Buffalo, New York, which led to the first union in the company's 51-year history. Portland baristas are hopeful, citing communication with other unionizing branches, and the company's stagnant anti-union strategy is working in their favor. Starbucks has also toned down its anti-union tone since former CEO Howard Schultz compared working at Starbucks favorably to riding a train to Auschwitz. If the successful union in Buffalo is any indication, the long union-resistant fast food industry could finally be ready for a shift. So far, Starbucks corporate has not recognized any unions at its stores. Starbucks has promoted itself for years as a good employer relative to other fast food chains, but employees say that it has fallen behind on compensation and benefits since the COVID pandemic. Other successful local labor movements at Kaiser, Nabisco, and Kroger have encouraged workers to unionize. Ethan Sandweiss, reporting for KBOO News.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler requested funding for 67 new police officers. That number announced today is in addition to the 300 officers Wheeler hopes to hire over the next 3 years. The Portland Police Bureau has had trouble replacing vacancies due to a combination of low retention and difficulty locating suitable candidates. Nonetheless, the City Council benchmarked $5.5 million last year toward quickly hiring new officers. According to Wheeler's latest proposal, quote, "Given the number of vacancies the Bureau currently has to fill and the training time required before a new officer is able to be deployed, it is difficult to prescribe these 67 police officers' positions to one task or function or state specifically what metrics they will impact." While Wheeler and some councilors hope that filling vacancies will decrease response times and crime rates, others have proposed budgets to increase funding for Portland Street Response, a team of unarmed medics and behavioral health specialists sent to address mental health events and homelessness. The Oregon Health Authority reports that Governor Kate Brown's January deadline for distributing 1 million COVID-19 vaccine boosters was not achieved. The state governor set the 1 million booster goal in December when the Omicron variant of COVID-19 first began affecting the population in Oregon. This goal was to be in addition to the 945,000 Oregon residents who had already received a booster prior to the goal being announced. By the end of January, only 504,000 additional booster shots were administered in the state. Oregon currently has the eighth highest rate of vaccinations in the United States. So far, 48% of vaccinated Oregonians have received their booster. State health officials believe that due to Oregonians being more committed to protective measures against the spread of COVID-19, the peak for hospitalizations is likely to be less than it was originally predicted. Despite failing to administer 1 million COVID-19 vaccine boosters by the end of January, Oregon is seeing the case numbers for the infection decline by 20% week to week. This data suggests that Oregon has reached the peak of the Omicron surge and cases are now receding. Oregon's legislative session began yesterday with heightened security. This is the first session open to the public since the start of the pandemic. With more, here's KBOO's Josh Salem.
Oregon lawmakers kicked off the 2022 legislative session in Salem Tuesday. The 35-day session began with the election of a new House Speaker. Dan Rayfield is a Democrat replacing Tina Kotek, who is running for Oregon governor. Priorities for the legislators include affordable housing, houselessness prevention, strengthening the state workforce to prioritize populations disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 and existing disparities, tax cuts, and limiting gubernatorial power. The new budget is eagerly awaited. Lawmakers await a revenue forecast, which should come soon. Democrats have predicted they could spend up to $2 billion in the upcoming session, and Governor Brown had asked lawmakers to set aside $500 million as a hedge against a downturn in the next budget cycle. The Capitol has COVID-19 safety measures in place, including a mask requirement. Republican lawmakers have criticized that policy and refused to follow it. Meanwhile, a crowd gathered outside the Capitol building to protest Oregon's statewide indoor mask mandate. The public is allowed to attend this session in person for the first time since March of 2020. There is increased security with metal detectors and X-ray machines to check bags. The question remains how well Democrats and Republicans can work together. Republicans have in the recent past used a variety of tactics, including walking out, to block bills they opposed. Both parties do have new leadership this session, including Tim Knopp, the new Republican state Senate leader, and Democratic Representative Julie Fahey, the new House Majority Leader. This session is the last for Governor Brown, who faces term limits. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon is a state famous for its natural beauty, and lawmakers are hoping that wildlife crossings can help protect its local fauna. With more, here's Eric Tagetoff.
A measure in the Oregon legislature aims to reduce vehicle collisions with wildlife. House Bill 4130 would allocate $5 million for wildlife crossings in problem spots across the state. In Oregon, there are about 7,000 collisions with deer each year, costing Oregonians $44 million in total. State Representative Ken Helm, a Democrat who represents the Beaverton area, is a chief sponsor of the bill. He says there's broad support for wildlife crossings, including some Republican co-sponsors.
These types of projects are not partisan. We've got Republicans and Democrats, senators and House reps on the bill already. It'll be a great bipartisan, bicameral effort and very popular. So the enthusiasm is certainly there in the state.
There are an average 700 injuries and 2 deaths from wildlife collisions each year. Oregon lags far behind on crossings at 5 compared with other states in the West. California and Utah each have 50. HB 4130 is scheduled for a public hearing today. Zach Schwartz, Oregon Program Manager for the Wildlands Network, says the crossings already have proven to be effective on a stretch of highway between Bend and Sun River.
The Lava Butte crossing on Highway 97 saw a decrease in wildlife vehicle collisions of about 85%. So they allow for wildlife to move much safer, they allow for drivers to drive on the highways safer, and they pay for themselves really quickly.
Tyler Dungannon with Oregon Hunters Association says the bill is a winner for the folks he represents. He says safe crossings also improve wildlife habitat and connectivity.
As conservationists, sportsmen and women aspire to bolster our deer, elk, and other game populations for the benefit of all Oregonians. And one way to do that is to reduce wildlife vehicle collisions on our highways via wildlife crossing structures.
Supporters of the bill also are hopeful passing it would put the state in a better position to compete for the $350 million federal dollars from the Wildlife Crossings Pilot Program, passed as part of Congress's infrastructure bill last year. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
Geologists have detected pulses deep underground the Three Sisters volcanic complex near Bend, Oregon. Scientists say that the light earthquakes are the result of magma moving 4 miles beneath the surface. John Majors of the Cascades Volcano Observatory says there's no reason to worry, as there isn't enough activity to constitute an immediate threat. The ground around the mountains reportedly rose about an inch in the past several days. The vice president's role in ceremonially counting electoral votes is being reevaluated over a year after a lethal mob attempted to force then-Vice President Mike Pence to overturn election results. With more on that story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Historically, the vice president's role as president of the Senate is really supposed to be a pretty ceremonial or ministerial role, opening up the certificates and presenting them to the chambers of Congress to count.
Efforts to reform the Electoral Count Act of 1887 are picking up steam. Legal counsel at Protect Democracy, Genevieve Nadeau, explains the statute is intended to preserve the ability to object to the Electoral College certification in extreme situations. 3 Democratic senators have a draft bill to reform the act, which includes curbing the power of the vice president during the certification. A bipartisan group of senators is also looking at updating the act as part of an election overhaul bill. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says he would not support shortening any of the sentences of January 6 protesters who pleaded guilty to crimes.
What we saw here on January the 6th was an effort to prevent the peaceful transfer of power from one administration to another, which had never happened before in our country.
That's a different position than former President Donald Trump, who'd said he'd consider pardoning the protesters if he were to become president again. A resolution will be introduced at this week's RNC winter meeting calling for Republicans Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger to be removed from the January 6th House committee. The proposal currently has 50 co-sponsors. Senator Ben Ray Lujan is expected to make a full recovery after experiencing a stroke last Thursday. The New Mexico Democrat is currently hospitalized and underwent surgery to ease swelling on his cerebellum. A Senate hearing Tuesday focused on the impact of the pandemic on mental health.
I've never seen our mental health care services stretch so far beyond their capacity as they are now.
Boston University School of Medicine psychiatry professor Michelle Durham testified about the need for coordinated care, while other experts called for more children's mental health resources and expanded access to telehealth visits. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday accused the U.S. of ignoring his security demands in a written document delivered to Moscow last week. However, he sounded hopeful that a diplomatic solution to the Russia-Ukraine crisis could be reached. Israel is rejecting new accusations about its actions towards Palestinians. Secretary General of Amnesty International Agnes Callamard detailed the new report findings, which she says include denials of basic rights and freedoms.
We are here today to call on the international community to take resolute action against the crime of humanity being perpetrated.
State Department spokesman Ned Price said the U.S. rejects the view that Israel's actions constitute apartheid. President Joe Biden kicked off Black History Month with a Twitter video celebrating Black stories as essential to the ongoing story of our nation.
Black culture is America's culture, and we're America because of the centuries of struggles and achievements of Black Americans.
Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael has been to Punxsutawney.
While at times the news makes every day seem like Groundhog Day, Trump lying about something, suing somebody, but the main thing that keeps happening is the old bait and switch. How could the Cold War have ended when defense spending keeps rising as we also keep making waves on the other side of the Pacific? I want to paint on the biggest American yachts your tax dollars at work. Yes, it's tax time again, but don't try to use your public services like the police, because there's not enough of them. Portland asked 80 retired officers to come back. Two said okay. While in hospitals and health plans we pay for, you need to wait months for an appointment, because 1 in 5 healthcare workers have left their jobs since COVID began. As the occasional homeless campground being cleared out changes nothing. So break your habit of hiding behind a screen. What aren't you using that you can give away? What do you need that you can get from a small local business, and go get it yourself? Wander a little. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the student debt freeze, followed by Noise Filter. At 6, it's Rhythm Nation. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Rain and temperatures in the 40s tonight, clearing up tomorrow morning for a cold gray day. Today is 2-2-22. Ulysses by James Joyce was published 100 years ago on 2-2-1922. The quote of the day is from Ulysses. Love loves to love love. A Tennessee school board voted unanimously to ban the graphic novel Mouse last month, one of the best-known books about the Holocaust. Among reasons given for the ban were a drawing of a nude woman and 8 curse words. The ban was condemned by the Holocaust Memorial Museum, NAACP, and Anti-Defamation League, among others. Since news of the school board's decision leaked, Mouse has become the number one bestseller on Amazon, and comic book stores in Tennessee have begun providing school kids with the book for free. The ban on Mouse has not occurred in a vacuum. Republicans crusade against so-called critical race theory and have led to the ban of numerous books addressing race and LGBT issues. Recently elected Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin campaigned in favor of censorship in schools, specifically targeting Toni Morrison's Pulitzer-winning book, Beloved. On one Virginia school board that recently voted to ban all books with sexually explicit content, 2 members advocated burning books removed from school libraries. Book burnings were common in Nazi Germany, although it's unclear whether the board members were aware of that history. 14 historically black colleges received bomb threats yesterday on the first day of Black History Month. Thankfully, after cancellations and shelter-in-place orders, these threats were confirmed to be unsubstantiated. Nevertheless, schools are asking for police protection and FBI investigation. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters that Homeland Security was providing regular updates to President Biden and other staff members. A group of federal lawmakers wrote to the Department of Justice requesting information on the disturbing trend. The FBI reported this morning that six juveniles have been identified as persons of interest in the case. Native tribes have reached a settlement with Johnson & Johnson for opioid deaths. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Federally recognized tribes have reached a major opioid settlement. The Associated Press reports the agreement between tribes, the drug company Johnson & Johnson, and three distributors totals $590 million. Federally recognized tribes can participate in the settlement, which is to be used to address the opioid epidemic. Johnson & Johnson and its U.S.-based Janssen companies will pay $150 million. Tuesday, the company said the settlement is not admission of liability or wrongdoing. The rest of the settlement money will be contributed by the companies AmerisourceBergen, McKesson, and Cardinal. Chairman of the Spirit Lake Nation, Douglas Yankton, told the AP the settlement will help fund crucial, culturally appropriate services on the reservation. As the Washington football team unveils its new name, Native groups and advocates say it's time for no more Native mascots in all professional sports. The Native-led nonprofit, Illuminative, is among groups leading Change the Name efforts across the country, saying Native mascots, team names, and imagery perpetuate racism and stereotypes harmful to Native people. The group Not in Our Honor, made up of college students, Native American leaders, and American Indian organizations in the Kansas City metropolitan area, is hopeful the Kansas City football team is next. Rhonda Lavaldo, Native journalist and tribal college educator in Lawrence, says it's more than just about sports.
A lot of people always say, well, just don't go to the game or just don't watch it on TV. Well, that's not that easy because it's everywhere. It's on billboards. It's on the sides of buildings. It's, you know, commercials. It's on the radio, the chop. They do it during concerts. And so it's not just the game. It's not just turning the channel. You know, it's affecting our little kids that go to kindergarten all the way through 12th grade and then all those that are in going to school at high school. It's just so nuts at how crazy this culture is with this Kansas City Native imagery. And that's what we're trying to do. That's why we want to do this, because I would like at one point that a child, a Native American child, does not have to deal with this anymore.
Advocates are seeking change from not only the Kansas City team, but other professional sports teams. On Wednesday, the Washington football team unveiled its new name as the Commanders in a nearly two-minute video posted on the team's website. The Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is holding a hearing Wednesday on the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, known as NAGPRA. Senators are expected to hear about impacts of the 30-year-old law and needs for the future. The law has provided for the repatriation of human remains, funerary objects, sacred objects, and objects of cultural patrimony. Witnesses include federal officials and tribal NAGPRA practitioners from Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington, D.C. The hearing is being streamed online at indian.senate.gov. The National Caucus of Native American State Legislators wrote a letter to President Biden this week asking for the release of Leonard Peltier from prison. The letter expresses concern for the 77-year-old who recently tested positive for COVID-19 and his poor health related to diabetes. His attorney and former federal judge, Kevin Sharp, talked about Peltier's health Monday on Democracy Now!
It's difficult to get information out of the BOP, the Bureau of Prisons. He tested positive on Friday, and so there were people there that I was able to talk to. He's doing okay and has not had to been moved yet.
The AIM activist has been imprisoned for decades after being convicted for involvement in the killing of federal agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in the 1970s. The letter from Native state lawmakers requests Peltier be released and allowed to go home to the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa in North Dakota. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A convoy of Canadian truckers is blocking a key border crossing in Alberta. The so-called Freedom Convoy was organized to protest a new Canadian law prohibiting unvaccinated truckers from entering the country. These truckers are violating an Alberta law passed in 2020 against Indigenous activists who are blocking railroads. Some conservative lawmakers who supported the bill when it was passed are calling for the truckers to be exempted. The protest was condemned by Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who said, quote, "There is no place in our country for threats, violence, or hatred." One police officer was assaulted following a head-on collision when a trucker plowed through a roadblock. A demonstration by truckers in the capital city of Ottawa last week led to several assaults. The Conservative Party of Canada is facing an internal revolt over the anti-vaccine movement, as party leader Aaron O'Toole was lambasted for meeting with some of the protesters. Canada has an 80% vaccination rate, and vaccine deniers are an unpopular minority. According to the Canadian government, over 90% of truckers are vaccinated. On the one-year anniversary of Myanmar's coup, people across the country participate in a silent general strike. Here's Josh Salem.
1 year after the military of Myanmar ousted democratically elected Prime Minister Aung San Suu Kyi, civilians across the country participate in a silent strike against the junta. Despite threats from the military that anyone participating would be charged with terrorism, the streets of cities across the Southeast Asian country were vacant. Since the coup, over 1,500 Burmese people have been killed and nearly 12,000 have been arrested and tortured. The military has used live ammunition against protesters. Despite harsh military rule, civil resistance against the new government has not abated. In-person protests and online activism continue in the face of fatal retaliation. Others have taken up arms. Guerrilla attacks on police and military targets have been met with government airstrikes and the destruction of entire villages. Myanmar has been the site of more or less continuous insurgency since it gained independence from the United Kingdom in 1948. Even during the democratic era, Aung San Suu Kyi's government was accused by the United Nations of perpetrating ethnic cleansing against the Rohingya and Karen people. Hundreds of thousands are internally displaced, and many others live in refugee camps in neighboring Bangladesh. Myanmar has been internationally isolated since the 2021 coup. Ethan Sanders reporting for KBOO News.
The U.S. deployed an additional 3,000 troops to NATO allies in Europe this morning in response to the escalating Ukraine crisis. 2,000 will be stationed in Germany and Poland, and another 1,000 troops in Germany will be transferred to Romania. Compared to over 100,000 Russian troops deployed to three of Ukraine's borders, the presence is negligible. Ukraine has been a headline story for weeks as Russia amasses its armies and demands that NATO precludes Ukraine's membership. NATO members refuse to concede. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman projected that American forces would only be drawn into a direct conflict with Russia if Vladimir Putin decided to invade a NATO ally, such as Poland or Romania. Such an invasion remains unlikely. However, the White House expects a possible invasion of Ukraine within the next month and a half, which would be disastrous for the former Soviet country. The war against Russian insurgents has been simmering in Ukraine since 2014, when Vladimir Putin annexed the Ukrainian territory of Crimea and sent non-uniformed soldiers into the country's eastern provinces. While most of NATO is resolute against Russian aggression, Germany has been reluctant to participate in the defense of Ukraine. The Central European powerhouse is overwhelmingly dependent on Russia for natural gas imports, and any conflict could lead to an energy crisis it is unprepared to handle. For Russia's part, Putin maintains that the United States is attempting to provoke a war in Europe, despite evidence to the contrary. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 2nd, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Josh Salem, Caitlin Bacchus, and Aurora Biggers. The producer is myself, Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegadoff, and Mary Sherman. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth report on the student debt freeze.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Originally set to resume February 1st, federal student loan repayments for 42 plus million Americans are now slated to resume May 1st, 2022. We have student loan hero counselor Andrew Pentis with us to talk about the freeze. Thank you for joining us, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course. So to get started, I'd like to know, right before the holidays, President Biden announced that the current moratorium on student loan payments that was set to expire originally in January would be extended until May 1st, 2022. What can you tell us about why Biden would extend the loan repayment freeze?
Yeah, it's a major surprise in retrospect, because the fourth extension, Biden had called the final one. So this fifth one definitely caught many borrowers by surprise. But I think given the Omicron variant during the pandemic, as well as rising inflation in the economy, probably pushed the administration to reverse course and decide to extend this moratorium on federal loan payments a fifth and perhaps final time.
And what effect will this 90-day extension have nationally?
Yeah, so it's more of the same in states beyond Oregon, where borrowers are getting an additional handful of months to sort of reacquaint themselves with their student loans. And it's particularly important for borrowers in other states who may be more likely to be experiencing a change in federal loan servicer. Some government contractors, such as Navient, have decided to leave the student loan industry. So millions of borrowers will not only be learning how to resume making their payments, but they may be doing so with a different loan servicer.
According to a Student Loan Hero data study, the average student debt balance for borrowers in Oregon